Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a chat about our selection of the 10 best books of 2012.
His children were falling from the sky. How are you not going to read the second sentence?
Caroline Weber reminds us of the glories of the rock group Duran Duran.
For girls of my generation, kind of people who grew up as preteens and teens in the 80s, they were the Beatles of my day.
Leslie Kaufman has notes from the field. Visuals columnist Stephen Heller is here to talk about some remarkable books for the holiday season. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This week, as we do once a year, we feature our 10 best books of 2012, and here they are, drumroll. 5 works of fiction, 5 of nonfiction. Fiction, Bring Up the Bodies by Hilary Mantel. Building Stories, or Building Stories, by Chris Ware. A Hologram for the King by Dave Eggers. N.W. by Zadie Smith. And The Yellowbirds by Kevin Powers. Nonfiction, Behind the Beautiful Forevers, Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity by Catherine Boo. Far from the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity by Andrew Solomon. The Passage of Power, The Years of Lyndon Johnson by Robert A. Caro. The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy by David Nassau. And finally, Why Does the World Exist? An Existential Detective Story by Jim Holt. Now, joining me once again, as they did last week, since we got no actual death threats that I'm aware of, after Parle Sagel and Greg Coles talked about the 100 notable books, we feel emboldened to have them talk about the 10 best books. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks.
All right, let's start with fiction. You two are both fiction experts. Hilary Mantel, what's going on there, Greg?
This book follows up Mantel's earlier Booker winner, Wolf Hall, and Bring Up the Bodies won the Booker as well. Both books, and a third that will come probably next year, maybe the year after, are looking at the life of Thomas Cromwell, the great advisor to Henry VIII, a commoner who came up through the court system, one of the great political minds of his time, who basically was responsible for the start of the Church of England, a big schism in the Catholic Church of the time.
And contributed to what? The marital adventures of Henry VIII.
Misadventures.
Exactly right.
And what is it, Parle, about Mantel's book? Look, there are a lot of historical novels out and about. There's some pretty good historical novelists. But she seems to have established herself as being apart from all others and ahead of all others. What is she doing that makes her so exceptional?
I think there's the depth of her research. First of all, she seems to have gone in and read every primary document that exists. And then there's the quality of her language. I don't think you can read the first page of that book and stop there. I think it begins, it has one of the best opening lines, I think, of the year, which is, his children were falling from the sky. How are you not going to read the second sentence? It's just beautifully, beautifully written. And it's bloody and gory and sexy. And I think it's, there's something for everybody.
There's also tremendous depth of psychology in both of those books. She gets very, very close to Cromwell's point of view, so much so that, you know, within the space of a paragraph, she'll be talking about King Henry and then Cromwell. And you're not always sure early on in the books until you've gotten a few pages in to establish that point of view. If she says he, usually she means Cromwell.
But not always.
Not always, because if Cromwell is looking at the king, then the king is he. But in the same paragraph, he will be back to Cromwell again.
Right, and she modulates all that with great dexterity.
She really does. And the effect of that is to put you right up close into Cromwell's head. And so it turns into a real study of psychology and political power and ambition.
All right, now we've got Building Stories by Chris Ware. Parle, what do we think?
Oh, I love this book. It follows the residents of a Chicago apartment building. This one woman, through her life, through college, some relationships, having a child, it comes in this box that's the size of a board game box.
That's like a game of Monopoly.
Exactly. And there are all of these elements. They're broadsheets, they're pamphlets. There's almost like one of those little like flip books that we used to look at when we were little. It's completely silent. There's no dialogue. And in your interview with Ware, he said that it was very important to have all of these sorts of different pieces that you can't even read the story chronologically, because he wanted people to handle them and move them around the way we do with memory. So it produces this very interesting effect and an interesting experience for the reader.
Greg, you know, this is the age of the graphic novel or the comic. Ware is one of the master practitioners. Well, has he taken it to a new level here?
He really has. And to the extent that it's the age of the graphic novel, Ware has a lot to do with that. Obviously, you had Art Spiegelman. Mouse won the Pulitzer back in the 80s raised the level, raised the bar on what comics could do. But now Ware is taking it to another level entirely by breaking it down into its component parts. And there's a very kind of fragmented modernist feel to this. You can approach it in any direction. It is, as Parl said, it operates in the same way that memory itself does. And you're accessing these people's lives in a way that feels very true to life. But it's not just new. He's also really looking back to old forms. Some of the fold-out sheets that are in there are tributes to the old Gasoline Alley days.
The little golden book.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So he's really paying tribute to what came before him, packaging all of these things together in a way that's artistically exciting, but also is so deeply literary. Mm. I mean, that's very novelistic what he's doing. You're going deep into these ordinary lives. And you really feel like you're living them to completion.
Yeah.
Okay. Then we have, speaking of an innovator, Dave Eggers' latest novel, his new novel, A Hologram for the King. Greg, you were really taken with this novel.
Yeah, I really was. It's funny. You're right, of course, that Eggers is an innovator. But his recent work has become more and more traditional in terms of its narrative approach. He's telling a story chronologically, very tight focus on a single character. What is maybe innovative about what he's doing now, or at least large in his approach, he used to write very pyrotechnic prose, and he's really quieted down a lot. And he doesn't have the footnotes, and he doesn't have the little marginalia that he established himself with in a heartbreaking work of staggering genius, the memoir about his parents' deaths. He's now instead thinking about America's place in the world. He's thinking about very big subjects, but approaching them in very traditional little ways.
Yeah, Parl, he's become kind of a global novelist in some ways.
Yeah, he's fearless. You can see it in What is the What and Zaytoun. He can inhabit bodies and stories from people of all races, of all ethnicities. I mean, and also people that have been suffered through atrocities. Like, there isn't that filter that, no, this isn't my story to tell. He finds what seems to be generally very sensitive ways of writing about history from the inside out.
And speaking of the inside out, let's not get Parl started on N.W. by Zadie Smith. This is your novel.
I have so many feelings about N.W.
All right, let's hear it.
I love this book just because I don't think, I mean, as you say with Eggers, it's so lovely to see a writer of Zadie Smith's stature changing and trying something new, and specifically bringing back some of the things that we haven't really seen since the modernists. You know, a real attempt to capture consciousness, a real attempt to look at identity as a set of intersectionalities. It isn't sometimes race or class or gender. For some people, it's race and class and gender, and how these general political forces shape our personal decisions is something that she explores in this book with great fluency. And it's deeply personal. There are intersections with her own life and her own trajectory. And it's a difficult book. And it's also Zadie Smith not necessarily being warm, being friendly, looking after the reader in the ways that, you know, White Teeth did and some of her more traditional books
right.
did. Here she challenges them. There's one part that's a section that's told in a list. You know, then there are snippets and fragments, and it's difficult. It's abrasive. It's a much meaner story. It's a colder story.
And our final fiction selection, a first novel, The Yellow Birds. Greg, this really impressed you.
Yeah, it really did. Kevin Powers was both an Iraq War veteran. This is a novel of the Iraq War, and also a poet. He has his graduate degree from the University of Texas at Austin in poetry, and that really turns up in the language here. And he's using the language and the form of the novel in a way that really gets at kind of the chaos of war and the way that it fractures your mind mentally. It's another, as we look over the fiction best books this year, it occurs to me that we were really won over by both ambition and experiment. There's a lot of, with Building Stories and with NW and with Yellow Birds, those are all books that are not told in a straightforward narrative. They're all kind of broken apart into pieces. And Kevin Powers does that too, to look at the effect of war on his protagonist's life. The protagonist had a friend who died during the war. We learned that right up front. It was a friend that he made a pledge to the friend's mother, I will protect him in the war. And you know within the opening pages of the book that he didn't do that. The friend died. But you don't know just how. And that kind of pulls you through the book to find out what happened. And as you do that, you just get kind of all the horrors of war and its aftermath.
Nonfiction. Catherine Boo, Behind the Beautiful Forever's Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity, won the National Book Award for this book. Boo's an extraordinary presence in American letters. And for the longest time, many of her admirers, me included, were expecting her to write the great narrative about poverty in America. But that's not what she did, Paul.
No, she didn't. She's written possibly one of the best books written about poverty, or one of the best books people are saying about India. I think this book is about 10 years in the making, and she spent it in Anawadi, a small slum in Mumbai. And this is both rigorously reported. There's one detail in the opening pages where she describes it's so early in the morning that even the goat's eyes are heavy with sleep. Like, this is how closely she's looked at this world.
In a great era, a kind of climactic era of narrative nonfiction, there are those, and again, I'm among them, who think this is a singular talent. And it's that mastery of detail,
yes,
of observation.
Yes, but you have to do both. I think that that's the thing. Like, she can do the kind of writing that I think people have come to expect about India, even from the fiction writers. It's sort of very lush and evocative, and it's beautiful, but there's suffering. But behind that, she has done a prodigious amount of research. Part of the book centers around a crime that she wasn't there, she didn't observe. How does she recreate that? Because she tells the book from the perspectives of these characters. She went and looked at census records, police records. India is not a country that's good at keeping documents. I don't know how she found them, but she did. She talked to everybody. She had to really create a space for her in this world with her interpreters. She had a team.
She doesn't speak?
She doesn't speak Hindi. I mean, even if she speaks Hindi, I'm sure she doesn't speak, you know, the dialect part of the slum. Like, they come from all parts of India. They have their own sort of street language. But she really, despite all of these obstacles, or maybe because of some of these obstacles, has created this incredibly cinematic look at this small slum that just exists in a swamp.
She's an outsider coming into an area very suspicious of outsiders, and very suspicious of even anyone from outside of this particular slum because they've been mistreated by everyone. She's revisiting a disputed crime. And so when Parle says it's a book 10 years in the making, part of that is she just needed to establish their trust. She needed to really live there and become part of the fabric of it, so to the point where she became invisible to them and they could finally open up to her, go on with their lives as if she weren't there. It's also an age of the memoir. A lot of the narrative nonfiction these days, the writer is a central figure in the story that he or she is telling. Catherine Boo is not like that. She, in the same way that she stays there long enough to disappear from their lives, she disappears from the book. She just is, you know, she's really the fly on the wall, and she's not putting herself there as a consciousness in the book, except, of course, the brilliant consciousness who's narrating.
Because she's not there, it doesn't become an American is looking at this world, and we're going to start from the beginning. No, it begins in medias res. It begins, you know, the sun is rising, the scavengers are out, they're doing the trash picking. So it's a much deeper look at those lives.
And another miracle of empathy, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Extraordinarily ambitious and huge book by Andrew Solomon. Greg, any thoughts about this?
Again, another miracle of empathy and research. Just like the Boo book, Solomon spent, I think, 10 years. Interviewing hundreds and hundreds of families of these who he calls horizontal children. It's a look at extreme parenting. These are children who vary in some way. When he calls them horizontal, he means that they are different. Instead of the vertical line of the generations, you have these kids who branch off that line because they are different from their parents.
And in profound and fundamental ways.
In extreme ways,
they don't
right.
share traits. For example, like race is a vertical identity. You know, you're black, you're going to have a child who's going to face the world in that same way. But if you're deaf, how do you, what does that mean? You have to learn a different language.
Right, if you're the deaf child of a hearing parent.
Exactly, you know, so this is the
right.
And he covers a tremendous spectrum, child criminals.
Transgender children, children who are conceived in rape.
Geniuses.
Prodigies.
That's yeah, right. Right. Extraordinary.
He talks
like
about
all of us here.
And also a maestro of storytelling.
I mean, it's like the point that Greg made about the fictionless is that these are books that are not only amazing stories, they're books that pay attention to how the story is told. When you're reading Solomon's book, it's very, very interesting because they're just series of case studies. It's told with great simplicity and humility, and he just goes in and he says, look at this family. This is what happened. This is the child that was born. What did they do? And it's enthralling. And he does provide analysis that's the connective tissue, but by and large, it really is the decisions that you make, what your family becomes given these situations.
He's also an incredibly elegant writer, as is Boo. And every sentence is he writes aphorism beautifully. Mm-hmm. And so it's a book that's just filled with sentence after sentence that you want to copy down into a notebook and quote back.
Well, here's another author who is maybe the researcher's researcher. That's Robert A. Caro with the fourth volume of his extraordinary monumental epic, The Years of Lyndon Johnson. This one's called The Passage of Power. And it tells what would seem to be a fairly simple story. The downtime for LBJ when he is the most humiliated of all modern vice presidents. And he's always mocked and ridiculed by the Kennedy White House, by these Harvard-educated sophisticates, and he's Rufus Cornpone from Texas. Mm-hmm. But then, classic Caro dramatic style, something happens that turns the story around.
Is the Kennedy assassination the climax of that book?
It's the climax, yeah. It's the climactic moment in the book. There is something that verges on the voyeuristic in his description of Johnson in this particular book. He doesn't just tell you how miserable Johnson was. He takes you inside the skin of Johnson. If he was humiliated 11 times in 2 weeks, then Caro's going to tell you about each one of those occasions and the 73 people he found who remember it. Yeah. And then you realize what's happening is this is why Caro is actually a literary artist. You become complicit in the murder of John F. Kennedy. You want Lyndon Johnson's suffering to end. So when the big section opens, it says Dallas, there's this little frisson you feel, and that's why he's a great artist, for those of you who wonder. So it's interesting also in this year where we see this titanic figure of the 1960s revived, Lyndon Johnson, also the missing Kennedy. You know, we know so much about the Kennedy clan, the Kennedy dynasty. David Nassau went to the beginning, which is Joseph Kennedy. And Arthur Schlesinger once said in his biography of Robert Kennedy that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a far greater man than his friend and sometime adversary, Joe Kennedy. But Joe Kennedy was the far greater father, and his life was really about his children.
In fact, isn't Joe Kennedy the reason that LBJ was president at all? Didn't JFK pick Johnson as his vice president because Joseph said, you need him for Texas?
That was one of the calculations and a very important one. And you remind me that some of the news in Caro's book is the demythologization of the choice of Lyndon Johnson. You're right, that the story in the Kennedy circle was always, well, Jack didn't really want him to be vice president. He didn't really want that kind of comic, gargantuan, uncouth figure in his administration. And Caro dismantles that and shows you how Kennedy knew he needed him. As early as the 1950s, Joe Kennedy was plotting his son's ascension to the presidency. In 1956, Jack Kennedy was a front runner to be Adlai Stevenson's vice presidential nominee, which would seem to be good for him that he missed it, you know. But Joe Kennedy was the maestro behind it all. This story tells also, or revives for us, reminds us of just this horrible strain of dynastic tragedy that ran through the Kennedys. And in the end, that's what really makes them so rich for us, is the suffering that came with all the extraordinary success. And now our final book, Why Does the World Exist? An Existential Detective Story by Jim Holt. Parle, this is a favorite of yours.
This is true. And we get to end on like a happy note, because it's a fun romp. It seeks to answer the question, why is there something rather than nothing? And Holt is sort of the mediator and messenger of interpretations from cosmologists and philosophers. And
he tracks them down, right? He goes all over the place.
He tracks them down, and he's like, I think I read in a review that he's sort of like the Studs Terkel of this sort of world. And he just has these great, boozy, associative conversations, and we get to listen in.
And who are some of the people he talked to? The novelist John Updike, for one.
Oh, that's right. Right?
Because Updike was this, you know, had big thoughts.
Epistemological.
But he also does scientists.
That's right.
Philosophers. And Holt is kind of a polymath himself, right? He writes for us a lot. He knows a lot about a lot of arcane areas. Well, it's a fantastic list. It was not easy at all choosing it. And we're imposing a new rule here that I've discussed with my colleagues. Because of so many scandals in the larger sporting world, all you 10 winners, don't rest easy yet. We're going to subject you all to a drug test. Thanks a lot, Greg Coles and Paul Sagal.
Thank you.
This is the age of the rock memoir, including memoirs by people I will admit I've never heard of, and now I'm going to be subjected to abuse. There's a new book called In the Pleasure Groove, Love, Death, and Duran Duran by John Taylor with Tom Sykes. It's reviewed for us by the brilliant Proustian, among other things, Caroline Weber, frequent contributor to the Book Review, who's here to talk about it. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Sam.
Our listeners won't believe it. We just spent 15 minutes or more with a very enthusiastic, not to say rapturous, discussion of Marcel Proust. We're now talking about Duran Duran.
Perfect.
So John Taylor, whom I never heard of, was this huge sex symbol?
It cannot be overstated how huge a sex symbol he and his four fellow band members in Duran Duran were in the 1980s.
So he was a bass.
He was the bass player. He was my imaginary boyfriend, as I say in the review. And for girls of my generation, kind of people who grew up as preteens and teens in the 80s.
Kind of MTV time.
Total MTV time. And in fact, that's a big part of the story, is one of the things that really catapulted Duran Duran to international fame was their very early adaptation of and very savvy and artistic exploitation of the music video form. Their album Rio, which was their second album and really their breakout album in the United States, 1982-1993, spawned some of the kind of hugest videos of the MTV 80s era. And that's how so many people like me discovered them, just watching TV 24/7 waiting for another appearance of these heartthrobs. They were the Beatles of my day.
And what was it about him in particular?
I always thought he was, and I'm of course biased, but I always thought he was the best looking one. A lot of women tend to like the front man, the lead singer, and in the case of Duran Duran, the lead singer, Simon Le Bon, was very charismatic, very handsome in his own way. But John Taylor had this kind of cool reserve. You sensed, and he even says in the memoir, that he never wanted to particularly be in the spotlight. He was quite happy, as he puts it, being a little bit downstage to the left. And that was his stage presence. That was his sort of presence in the videos. He never looked like somebody who really wanted all that attention, and yet that's, of course, the exact kind of guy that gets all the attention. And he tells a very funny story in the memoir about the group hanging out with Andy Warhol. I mean, these guys were friends with all of the big stars, all the big celebrities. Everybody was kissing up to them. Everybody wanted to know them. And Andy Warhol kind of sidles up to him and says, "You should be lead singer, John." And John says, "No thanks, Andy." But he had that kind of cool, laid-back reserve that I found hugely sexy, even before I knew what sex was. And the pleasant surprise, the amazing surprise, was that he's enormously appealing as a writer.
Yeah, you say the voice is the real surprise here.
The voice is really charming. And I think it's because I would have loved the book anyway, just because I was such a fan and because it's so interesting to read about the rise of Duran Duran from the other side. He opens up with this set piece of being on stage in 1982. They've essentially become famous overnight, wildly famous overnight, because of these videos, because of the teen female press in Britain, which made them into the kind of Fab Four of their day. There were five of them. And the opening set piece is just girls screaming so loudly that they can't even hear themselves play. And they're kind of looking at each other like, what on earth is this? And they realize that that's what their life is going to be like from now on, is just girls screaming mass hysteria everywhere they go. So that's an interesting story in and of itself to read if you were one of those girls screaming at the time. But what's even better is the fact that he walks such a beautifully fine line between acknowledging at every turn what a huge cultural phenomenon, pop cultural phenomenon Duran Duran were, and yet being incredibly self-deprecating and amusing and self-effacing in the way that he speaks about himself. And it's such a tricky line to walk. He never pretends like Duran Duran weren't the teen idols they were, but he doesn't ever seem to take himself all that seriously in recounting the various sort of ups and downs of being that famous. And so that's what I really loved about the memoir.
Carrie, did you listen to some of the music again when you worked on this piece?
I did. No? I enjoyed it so much, Sam. It was an excuse for me to re-listen to everything. I knew every note of every song they recorded from 1982 to the early 1990s. I think.
And does it hold up? Does it still sound good?
It holds up. It sounds great. And in fact, you know, kind of more in later years, I know that kind of current pop icons like Justin Timberlake have acknowledged them as predecessors. It really does hold up. It's great classic 80s pop. And it's got a very sophisticated rhythm section, too. I mean, John Taylor, one of the things one also learns in this memoir is how much involvement he had in these important collaborations that he had with really great funk musicians.
And, so he was a serious musician.
He was a serious musician, self-taught, but really serious. And so when you listen again to the rhythm sections, and you can really hear an evolution and increasing sophistication in the bass line in their music, and that's really wonderful. But it's almost frustrating. I because I loved him so much at the time, I didn't want to fall in love with him all over again, and the book had that unfortunate effect.
Now, Carrie, we have to do this just to establish our bona fides here. Tell our listeners what book you're working on now.
Oh, I'm working on a book that has nothing to do with Duran Duran. It's called Proust's Duchess, and it's about Proust and high society ladies in the Belle Époque in Paris.
Can't wait to read it. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Caroline Weber, who reviews In the Pleasure Groove, Love, Death, and Duran Duran by John Taylor with Tom Sykes in this week's book review. Leslie Kaufman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Leslie.
Hi.
So some kind of sad and disturbing news in the world of literature and book publishing.
David Oliver Rellen, the co-author of Three Cups of Tea. Most people forget about him. They remember Greg Mortensen, but it did in fact have a writer. He committed suicide. The Times broke the story, but he committed suicide in November.
Where? How old was he? Give us some.
He was young. He was 49, and he did it in Portland, which he had moved to just a few years ago.
Portland, Oregon.
And I guess the big question in the publishing industry, and one that we don't have an answer to, but is obviously in everyone's mind, which is how much did the scandal that surrounded Three Cups of Tea have to do with why he took his life?
So walk us through that scandal. It became quite a controversy because of the kind of admirable backstory, we thought, and it had become almost a kind of movement, certainly a franchise. And then questions began to be raised. So remind us of some of what happened.
Right. So, of course, Three Cups of Tea is about the story of Greg Mortensen, a climber who gets lost up in the Himalayan peaks and ends up in the village of Corfe, discovers they're poor, They rescue him. In the story, he's dehydrated. He discovers they're poor and starts raising money to build schools. He starts a charity called the Central Asia Institute. And the book takes us through this. It was a huge bestseller.
And it's a nonfiction book.
Just to be clear, it was a very moving story. It became a huge bestseller. The Pentagon even talked about it as a way to relate to people in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So it got a tremendous amount of coverage. Our own Nick Kristof wrote about it several times because he was talking about a way to build relationships that aren't war.
Our op-ed columnist, Nicholas Kristof. Right. Because it almost seemed to blend in with anxiety and also desire to know more about that part of the world, about Muslim culture at the time of the jihads and counterinsurgency. Is there a different way for us to relate to these people we don't seem to understand? It kind of fit right into all of
it. It was beautiful. It was beautiful. And it was very comforting to all of us. But then what happened under the category of things are too good to be true? In 2011, 60 Minutes teamed up with John Krakauer.
Very famous writer.
Into Thin Air is his most famous book, I think. But he had a bunch. And as you may recall from Into Thin Air, he's a climber. So he knows this community. He knows the community. And he's known for some time that this story isn't quite right. In fact, the whole opening anecdote with visiting the village of Corfe might not have existed, he argued. And they did this live on 60 Minutes, and it caused a huge tumult. Now, the big question, which is whether Greg Mortensen went on to misuse the funds from his charity, was the most devastating part of the indictment, and that didn't follow David Oliver Relin. But there was a question of whether Relin should have known. Relin always said that he had interviewed 200 people, had followed Mortensen's track. Should he know or did he know that these allegations, that Greg was essentially lying?
Right, that he, as the co-writer or maybe even ghost author of this book, so involved in its conception, its writing, the editing, and all the rest. It's one of those. How could he not have known this?
Right. And then you come up to the whole fascinating question of what actually publishers owe to the public when they give us a nonfiction book. When they tell us they're giving us a nonfiction book, are they promising us the exact truth, journalism as we would understand it? Or are they giving us a great story that's, you know, largely true? And so this was a very interesting. Unfortunately, they went to court. There was a class action case where people who had read the book brought a class action case. And here's the problem. Penguin made a lot of money.
That's the publisher.
Penguin, the publisher, made a lot of money on this book. They defended themselves. They probably made the most money on this book. By some estimates, maybe $60 million around.
You mean made more money than
The authors.
Right.
The book sold mostly in paperback, and the publisher really benefited from that.
Oh, it was a fixture on the bestseller list,
yes.
And our bestseller list.
Greg was indemnified by his charity, which means his charity paid his legal costs. But David, as his lawyer said, was paying his own costs. As this suit dragged out, it was financially draining to him. And it raises a question of what exactly is owed. Penguin in the lawsuit said, we told you it might not be true. If you had read the introduction, we did say that Greg was hard to pin down on the dates. You know, the basic things happened, maybe not in the exact order, but really, this is silly. And the case was dismissed, but they are trying to appeal it.
And so the cost, let's set aside the financial cost, the psychic cost would be tremendous for the co-author. Did he have a family? Are there survivors? Do we know much about him?
We do know a little bit about him. He had a wife, supposedly was happily married. We also know that he had a book with Random House on his own about optometrists who do amazing work with eye cataract surgery in the third world that has not come out yet. It's unclear why that book has taken so long to come out. We do know that Relin, with his own money, paid for a fact checker.
So Relin had completed the book.
He completed the book. It's now going to come out in 2013, in the spring.
And Leslie, just so our listeners understand, when you say this story was broken by the New York Times, what exactly does that mean?
Well, I think that Relin's death had sort of been known. The family took out a very mysterious personal sort of thing that said he died in the local paper.
Out in Portland.
Out in Portland. I think it was the Portland paper. It might have been the Rochester paper, where his family's from and where he grew up. I'm not sure. No one knew why. And the Times was the one who figured out that he had killed himself. And we published his obituary on Monday.
That's a sad story.
It's a very sad story.
Thanks so much, Leslie.
Thank you.
Steve Heller is a giant in the world of design and design criticism. He's also our eminent visuals columnist. It's a favorite among readers, and I think also will be listeners to the podcast who've heard him before, but those who haven't will be hearing him for the first time now. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Sam.
Okay, we've got a whole group of books here. We have an enticing headline called Yesterday's Tomorrow's. So this is really about futurism and visions of cities and such. But walk us through some of the highlights.
Well, the first book that I reviewed is about Norman Bel Geddes. Now, some of you in the audience may know the name Bel Geddes. That's because his daughter, Barbara Bel Geddes, was on Dallas and other television shows, and she was also in Vertigo.
She was in Vertigo. She's a girl. She's the friend.
She's the friend
of James Stewart.
Who really loves James Stewart.
Right in that gorgeous studio apartment with a fantastic
view. Right,
views.
Fantastic view. She was an actress, and Norman Bel Geddes was a scenic designer when he started out, among other things. He was really a polymath of visuals. He did comics, he did cartoons, he did illustrations, he did three-dimensional work, and he did sets. But what he's really known for and what this book brings out so beautifully is that he was one of the white knights of American industry. And by that, I mean he was an industrial designer before there were industrial designers. He was in that first wave that was called an industrial designer.
And what period is this, Steve?
This is around the Depression, 1930s. He, Raymond Loewy, Henry Dreyfuss, Walter Darwin Teague, these were the guys who really invented the field of industrial design in the 20th century.
And tell us what that means, industrial design.
Industrial design is the design of everything we use every day. It's the design of products. And it's making a product both look good and work efficiently. So what Norman Bel Geddes did, he created cars, he created ships, he created motorcycles, he created vacuum cleaners.
All these things that were actually manufactured and produced.
Many of them were actually produced. They called him the man who streamlined America because streamlining was the dominant style of that moment. And it was more than a style, although it took off and became a stylistic conceit. But when it started, it was a way of transforming American industry through the use of technology. Because what was happening before the Depression, there was a certain amount of stagnation in the economy because products never really got newer. You know, they were made well, they worked well, people didn't buy them. So that brought a stagnation, a stop to the economic growth.
You mean you wouldn't buy a new one? You had your washing machine and you wouldn't buy the new model. Or you had a car, a Model A, and you wouldn't buy the flashy newer model.
Exactly, because there was no real difference between the A and the next one in the A line. So there was a guy named Ernst Elmo Calkins. He was an advertising executive, came from the Midwest. His father was a preacher. And he became the forward-thinking visionary of modern art and design. His idea was you apply veneers to everything, and those veneers are stylistic, those veneers are temporal. So you can take an old product, put it in a new package, and or advertise it in a new way with a contemporary image, a contemporary typeface, and many contemporary words, and you can sell it as new.
And Steve, how much of this was an American phenomenon? Were there European influences?
Well, the European influence was the modern art itself. There wasn't a lot going on in the United States other than the shows, some of the exhibitions that we had. But Ernst Elmo Calkins, who really opened up the door for these industrial designers, he found all of this work in Europe, in France, in Germany. And he realized that America didn't have this legacy, this contemporary legacy, and he imported it, basically. At least the ideas were imported, and he encouraged his clients in the advertising business to go with modern art for advertising. He also coined something called styling the goods, and what that was a precursor to forced obsolescence. Now, Bel Geddes bought into this idea that newness would help stimulate the economy. But he was not one to just talk about the veneers or to work on the surface. Bel Geddes wanted to get under the hood. And that's what he and his other industrial design colleagues were doing. And his monument his the testament to all of this was the 1939 New York World's Fair.
Of course, it all seems to be leading that everything you described. That was a revolutionary moment in American cultural history.
It was an amazing moment because it was all about marketing. It was all about salesmanship, and the fair, its leader Grover Whalen, his director, brought all of these industrial designers together, brought all of these corporations, and most of them were motor corporations, GM, Ford, Chrysler, because the way industry saw itself as expanding was through the new interstate road systems, and that meant autos. That meant tires, that meant engines, that meant all sorts of things that the consumer would need to get from here to there.
And Steve, also, and maybe this came just a little bit later, but the romance of the car is so much a part of the American imagination.
And
too.
The romance of the car came through advertising and came through people like Bell Geddes, who wrote a book called Magic Motorways. Now, just put those two words together. They're alliterative, but magic and motorway. Now we say motorway, traffic.
Right.
You know, in those days, it's what you were saying. It's this romantic sense.
Right, the open road, the freedom.
Exactly. And so Bell Geddes was really one of the progenitors of that notion. And his pavilion at the New York World's Fair in 1939, the World of Tomorrow, as it was called, was the GM Pavilion, which was the largest and had the longest lines to get into it. And the exhibition that he designed was called Futurama. And you get into a little pod, and you literally fly over the future city, a very visionary city, because it was about sustainability, it was about green areas, it was about tearing down the slums and building beautiful skyscrapers that could sustain themselves. I mean, this was 1939, years before we started using sustainability as a buzzword.
Let's walk through a couple of these other books. It's so fascinating. How about the Book of Books, 500 Years of Graphic Innovation? That's of interest now when we're looking at the complete transformation of what delivery vehicles and platforms for reading.
The Book of Books is a big book, and it takes up a considerable amount of space to get 500 years in there, but it's a wonderful book because you see through the illustrations that are beautifully reproduced and very largely reproduced. The scale of the book is quite sensational. You see where we've been and where we've come in terms of this piece of technology.
So he goes all the way back to the beginning of the printed book?
He goes back to printed books. He doesn't really deal with incunabula. And he comes up to what we call the postmodern book, which is a book in a book in a book. Books that take on other forms, that are more about the object itself than the content of the book.
Well, to give an example, Steve, we were talking about this earlier. One of the book reviews choices, 10 best books of the year, Chris Ware's Building Stories. Is that a kind of postmodernist book?
That's definitely a postmodern. It's a box, and inside are all the contents. And what's the difference between that and a book? The only thing that's different is tradition. A book is usually bound, but it doesn't have to be. So Chris Ware's book is another piece of the evolutionary trail of books, except it goes back decades. It goes back many decades where boxes were used to contain books or slipcases were used to contain books.
And let's look at numbers and graphic design, Lawrence King.
Well, this also has a relationship to books because we always look for page numbers. This is an interesting book because graphic designers have to deal with page numbers. Usually it's an invisible, visible thing. You know, you look for it, but you don't dwell on it. You don't pay that much attention to it.
So when you say graphic designers have to deal with them, does that mean that they'd all rather not? Is it an imposition to have to stick the page number on each page?
Well, I'll tell you something. When I designed books years ago, I had to put in either running feet or running heads. Those are page numbers on the bottom or page numbers on the top, and it would have the chapter name or a chapter number or whatever. And it was always something that I left for last, and therefore it wasn't very special. What's interesting in this book is that when you see the really exemplary work, the designer has not only done something with the text or with a sign or the like, but has paid real attention to the numbers, that no detail goes lost.
But how many details are there? I mean, what can you do with a number?
Well, one of the sections in here that's most exciting are numbers for floors and buildings. These are things that you take for granted. But you can make these numbers 6, 10 feet tall. You can throw artificial shadows on the number. You can make them three-dimensional, and that way you're adding a kind of numerical sculpture to your architecture that grabs people's attention. You know where you are. It's functional, but it also has an aesthetic appeal as well.
All right, so let's do one last book, Silhouettes from Popular Culture. Ollie Moss, what's this?
This is an artist, an English artist and graphic designer, and you remember the silhouette was the photograph of the 17th and early 18th and early 19th century.
And those are the black.
Those are the black things, usually made with a cutout or a knife or something. And you would have them as a keepsake of your family, your children, your grandparents, whatever. So what he's done is he's taken that old trope and he's made contemporary popular culture figures out of them. And unless I missed something, I couldn't find any captions in the book to tell me who I was looking at. So I used the book as a kind of guessing game. How many people in popular culture did I recognize? And
so they're not identified at all otherwise.
They may be, and I may have missed it, maybe because the page numbers were too small. But I got about 50% right. There's one in the book review this Sunday of a character. I won't mention who it is, but I couldn't figure out who it was. I had to read the caption. But he's as obvious as the chair you're sitting in.
Oh, yes. A man who had public performance that involved the chair, didn't it?
Exactly.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Thanks, Sam.
That's Steve Heller, who this week reviews many books in his great visuals column. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. What's on the list this holiday week, Greg?
Well, it's quiet days in bestseller land, Sam. Just two new books on the fiction side of things. At number two, Michael Connelly's latest Harry Bosch novel, The Black Box, is new on the list. That's at number two. It is, I think, it's either the 20th Harry Bosch novel or the 20th anniversary of the first Harry Bosch novel. Either way, it goes back 20 years looking at a case right after the L.A. riots.
The Rodney King riots.
Yeah, exactly. And there was a body recovered there that Harry Bosch is now going back and trying to solve that case. And then at number one, Jim Butcher has a novel called Cold Days. He writes these kind of contemporary Chicago fantasy wizard books, and this is one of those.
Nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side, there are also just two new books lower on the list than the fiction side. At number 10, Carol J. Loomis, who's an editor at large at Fortune magazine, has compiled an anthology of articles from Fortune, both by and about Warren Buffett, America's favorite billionaire. He's been much in the news lately, of course, because he advocates higher taxes for the wealthy. Readers love reading about him. There have been two biographies of him that both hit the list. There's been an investment guide on how to invest like Warren Buffett. Buffett himself has never written a book, but he has written articles over the years for Fortune. Carol Loomis is a friend of his and kind of a Warren Buffett specialist over at Fortune. And so she's pulled together all of these articles that he wrote and also articles that other people wrote about him. Into a book called Tap Dancing to Work, which is new at number 10.
Now, in your column, you mentioned some interesting parallels between Warren Buffett and another famous Buffett.
Yeah, this is maybe my favorite article included in that book. The title of the article is Are Jimmy and Warren Buffett Related? It's by a guy who used to write for Fortune named Tyler Maroney. And you started off thinking that it's, you know, just straight comedy, that it's satire.
So this is Warren Buffett and the Margaritaville Jimmy Buffett guy.
That's right. Cheeseburgers in Paradise, pina coladas and getting caught in the rain. That guy. Maroney starts his article listing some parallels between them, mostly goofy parallels. Warren Buffett, it turns out, seriously, literally plays the ukulele quite well. It's apparently a skill that he learned trying to win a girlfriend away from another ukulele player. And he wanted to prove that he could
out ukulele the first guy.
Exactly. He didn't get the girl, but he did learn the ukulele, and it's a skill that he has continued over the years. So you start this article thinking that Maroney is just kind of doing this on a lark, but it turns out that Warren Buffett's sister Doris, who's a big philanthropist, got interested in family genealogy a ways back, and she sent letters to all the Buffetts she could find in the U.S., including Jimmy Buffett, who said, huh, that'd be interesting, and how great would it be to be related to Warren Buffett? Maybe I'd inherit some money. And the two men got to know each other. They weren't able to figure out, are they related? They thought, you know, maybe we are. There can't be that many Buffetts in the world. But Loomis posts an addendum, writes a little coda at the end of this article, saying that 7 years after the article appeared in Fortune, both men submitted to DNA testing, and in fact, they are not related. At number 8 on the nonfiction list, the other new book on the list this week is Nassim Nicholas Taleb's Anti-Fragile. Taleb, of course, was a big bestseller with his book The Black Swan back in 2007 and early 2008. He got his start as a finance guy, really a quantitative trader, real statistical analyst, kind of numbers cruncher. And in The Black Swan, he took this Malcolm Gladwell approach, the big idea that explains the world. The big idea of The Black Swan was that every now and then there are random events that you cannot predict. No formula will tell you when they're coming. And so the trick is to make money off of these random events. If you can't see them coming, how do you profit from them? In that book, he forecast, you know, with some hedges, but he said that there might be a big disaster on the way.
Economic disaster.
Economic disaster. That the banks were getting too big, and if one bank fell, then the rest would follow like dominoes. And so when just that happened in 2008, the start of the financial crash that whose repercussions are still being felt today, a lot of people in the financial world, including friends of mine, started citing Taleb as kind of a prophet, like a mystical guru almost. And Anti-Fragile, the new book, takes him further in that direction to the point that he's now turned a lot of people off. He's spouting, going back to Sparta and the ancients, saying this is how you must live. And he presents himself as this kind of philosophical mastermind. He's gotten away from finances almost entirely. But the basic premise of Anti-Fragile is that bad things are going to happen to everybody, to every institution.
At one time or another.
Exactly. If you are too rigid, those things will destroy you. If you are sturdy, then you'll survive those things. But if you are anti-fragile, you will not only survive them, but they will improve you. You will be able to adapt. That's kind of the idea of evolution.
What does not kill me makes me stronger. What does anti-fragile mean, though? How does he derive that term?
He's invented that term, and he comes up with it. It's a neologism just to kind of encapsulate this big idea. Exactly that. There's a lot of Nietzsche in this book as well. What does not kill me makes me stronger.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.